This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. George Saunders is a master of the short story. His work has been likened to that of Kurt Vonnegut and Mark Twain. He is known for his smart, satirical takes on American society, all employed with humor and empathy. He won a Booker Prize for his novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, and his last short story collection, 10th of December, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Well, nearly a decade after publishing that collection, George Saunders is out with a new one. It's called Liberation Day. And George Saunders, welcome to Press Play.
Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So many of these stories take place in a somewhat dystopian future, if I can use that term.
I think you can. Yeah. <That's> understated.
I know. It's overused and yet so applicable these days. So you've got at least four of them that take place in this dystopian future. And before we go down and talk about each one in particular, I just want to get an overall sense from you about why you're attracted to this idea.
Yeah. You know, there's a great Flannery O'Connor quote. She says, a writer can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. And that, it took me like 20 years to figure that out. But you can think you're a certain kind of writer, but your prose is going to straighten you out. You know, so I have just found that if I put a story in a weird place, like an almost obnoxiously weird place, it just does something to my approach that makes the story better. And I think it's because it forces me to lose control in a certain way. You know, if it it kind of destabilizes the whole platform. So suddenly you're in this weird theme park and you're just kind of desperately paddling to keep the reader with you. And somehow that takes the controlling mind off the table a little bit. And it just makes kind of more uncertainty and fun.
So you like the setting, for example. I mean, you mentioned theme park. There is one story, Ghoul, that actually does take place in a theme park, but it's underground and people can't escape.
Yeah, that kind of theme park.
Yeah. Talk about that story a little bit. Set it up for us.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's right. I mean, really, the way I get to the theme park is through voice. So I like to do, I just like to do kind of crazy off-kilter voices. So without any thought of what the story would be about or even where it was set, I just started doing a certain voice that I can kind of do, you know, pretty easily. And that's just fun. You know, you're just kind of riffing. And then at some critical moment, you have to say, okay, wait a minute, what's going on here? You know, and then you have to start kind of constructing the story out of the voice that you've already made.
So the voice in this case is a guy who plays a ghoul. His name is Brian. And Brian the ghoul in this scene in a theme park. So it's kind of like clocking in like the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote when they clock in for a day's work. It's sort of like that in a way. And he assumes the position of a ghoul all in this theme park where people are supposed to come, but they never do. So there are no visitors at all. It's just the people acting out these scenarios. How did you come to that idea that they would just be performing emptily?
Honestly, just step by step. You know, you get absorbed in a certain joke or a certain moment. And then in the course of trying to make that thing livelier in the language, you suddenly will kind of blurt out something that you didn't know. So in this case, he was having a conversation with another character and the character said something obliquely about there not being very many visitors. And I just noticed that in the prose, my hero kind of froze up in terror that he had said that, you know. And it was just a funny line, a funny exchange. So at that point, you have two choices. One is to overwrite what your subconscious has produced, or what I like to do is just go with it and say, okay, my subconscious just told me that there's a theme park and it never gets visitors. That's weird, you know. And then you sort of go, okay, well, let's accept that. And you're kind of saying to the story, okay, I'm going to trust that if I just keep trying, you're going to start saying something that's not trivial and it's maybe even universal. So in that one, there's a point about three quarters of the way through where I'm like, oh yeah, so is there any way in which I, in my, you know, mind and body feel trapped and that sometimes I'm just, everything I do is futile. I'm like, yeah, especially lately I feel that way, you know? So as I'm writing even a really crazy story like this, I keep thinking, would my perfect reader be feeling any resonance with her life? And I always try not to go much further than that. I don't want to pin it down or force a meaning on her, but I want us to be in it together, feeling that this isn't irrelevant to the real core issues of our life, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, you really do that in Love Letter, and this is about a grandfather's regrets that he didn't do more to confront fascism in America when he could have. He's writing a letter to his grandson and urging him not to do anything rash that might anger the authorities. This really does seem to be set in what might be the near future.
Yeah, and it's set in my mind in the near future, because that was really just kind of a moment of feeling so agitated and frustrated and a little bit scared that I thought, all right, I'm just going to put this in a character's head and see what happens.
Did you start out thinking, I need to write something about creeping fascism in America?
Yes. And about my own, agitation and frustration about it.
And did you do that for yourself? Did you do that for your readers, for your students, for who do you want to talk to in this?
I mean, the honest answer is I did it because I felt like other people must be feeling it, and then I would be doing something, I don't know, that people would like, really. You know, I mean, partly you do it for yourself, but also it's like maybe I can get in there and I guess to some extent offer comfort, but also maybe I could stir up the pot a little bit. So that it's a complicated thing in any story. You know, on the one hand, you're trying to do it for your own development. You're also, your ego is saying you could really nail this, you know? And there is also in there, in the mix, there's a little bit of benevolence, like maybe I could reach out and reassure somebody somewhere. So it's kind of a complicated mix, but at this point, it's just a feeling. Like if something feels urgent, then I just try it.
And I guess I'm wondering how you balance this idea of, you know, you don't want to be didactic because then it kind of tips over into something else, more like propaganda than art. But you also want to have a message, and you want to have a light touch, and you have the humor and all that. And I'm wondering how difficult it is to balance all of that in a short story.
What I try to do is say to myself, okay, eventually we want this piece to, you know, kind of like a cake, we want it to rise. And it's going to rise from the merely opinionated or propagandistic or factual into, you know, a proper short story, which for me always means that you take all that particularity and then it ascends into something that's more universal. So in this one, it started out to be me venting. But then in the process of writing it, I think I would say it became a story that could speak to people in any time when a person is failing to rise to the occasion of the historical moment. You know, so in my reading of it, this grandfather is making a case to his grandson, but even as he does it, he's getting a little wobbly. He's hearing himself speak these things and he's like, wow, I'm not really giving him good advice. And just at the end, he actually makes an offer of a cash gift that completely contradicts the whole text, you know. So for me, when that happens, when it starts becoming about a human tendency, you know, one of the experiences of my adult life is just to go, it's kind of hard to stand up. So I loved a story that kind of gets in there and says, now, wait a minute, let's really be honest about our capabilities and try to figure out how is it that in a world where people are generally, they seem so well-intentioned, you know, how do things so go off the rails, you know? Why is it that in moments of great historical crisis, it seemed like so many people were quiet? Mm-hmm. And you could say, oh, they were cowards, unlike us. But in fact, you know, 1939 or 1911 or 1840, it's not really different. So fiction is a way to kind of take a little breath, slow things down, and get into those little cracks and say, well, how do people actually behave? And when they behave badly, how do they rationalize it to themselves?
So that's on a kind of a bigger, more historical geopolitical tack. But then you also have in a short story called A Thing at Work, you have that same idea play out like in the office break room. Mm-hmm. And so there's a clash of status and education in this office, and these two women are at odds. Describe this world for us, this world in this office.
It was, I mean, physically, it was a place I used to work years ago when before I got my first book out. And it was, I worked for an engineering company in this kind of, it was a corporate mall. It was called Corporate Woods. And so I spent 7 or 8 years there with a lot of great people who aren't like these people in the story. But while I was there, it occurred to me that, you know, like any system, there were power structures, you know, and they were unacknowledged. But even in that group of 12 people, there was a real pecking order. And in the story, there's a woman who's a word processor, we used to call them. And, you know, she's not a college graduate. She just come out of jail. She's working there. And over many years of writing it, it became a kind of a meditation on how power preserves itself. You know, those kind of quiet winks that power does go, you know, let's not talk about that right now. Let's sort of take out the weakest in the herd, you know. And it also became a kind of a nice years-long experiment in my own empathy. Like, who am I rooting for here? Can I write the story so that I'm actually rooting for everybody? You know, that was sort of the goal.
Yeah, I was going to say, because originally, what's interesting about this story is that you don't like the underdog, Brenda. She's a not very likable person at first.
Right. Yeah. She comes out of the gate and there's a scene on the bus where she just levels this guy who hasn't done anything to her. She's just, in her mind, she just takes him. So yeah, that's the fun part is, you know, to develop antipathy and sympathy in the same paragraph is really fun, you know, because isn't that kind of like life, you know? I mean, we have all these things firing at once and we can like somebody and really not like them. And we can admire somebody and suspect their motives and, you know, everything happens at once.
And then you implicate us in it, because I just want to read a little description of Brenda that you write on the first page. Brenda was small, round, sweet, standing there in one of those too short blouses she was always tugging down over her toddler-esque belly. Elfin, if you were feeling generous. That's funny. And I caught myself laughing. And then I realized I was laughing at her. And then I felt guilty.
Yes, that's exactly where I wanted you, because, you know, it's actually in that, I mean, that, and then we find out a bit later, that is actually in the point of view of the other, of Jen, the other woman. But as you say, I didn't tell you that yet. So, So you and I and are both looking askance at this woman who's just standing there having coffee, and we're kind of already making fun of her.
Already judging.
Yeah. And so I think that, judging is the word, because as soon as I can get you judging somebody, you're in. You know, because we like that. We do. I mean, it's a Darwinian survival mechanism to judge. So I get you judging, and all of a sudden now you're judging. You're having some fun doing that because it is fun, but you're also having some guilt about judging this poor woman. Then we can go forward, and then the rest of the story could, or even just the next beat of the story, could be understood as me sort of exploiting that feeling that you had, exploiting your judgment, also exploiting your guilt about having the judgment. And we're off to the races, you know.
Ooh, I guess I was manipulated. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, but you know, this is the beautiful thing is, so was I, because, you know, when I typed that thing, I had exactly those same feelings. I typed it kind of doing a little visual imagination and make it into a sentence, read it and went, ooh, that's pretty mean, but it's pretty funny. So in a sense, I think what's happening in a story is I'm going first and stepping into these traps, you know, then I'm messing with the traps a little bit so they're more effective. Then I'm saying, come on, Madeline, come on, you follow me. So that's really what, that's really what a story is. It's kind of like a roller coaster that I have, you know, the metaphor breaks down, but I made a roller coaster where I could experience one hill at a time and then I could perfect it, do the next hill, then et cetera. And then when it's done, I ask you to write it.
Hmm. So you can't really fall too deeply in love with your own characters because they're so complicated. Or do you? Because they're so complicated.
I think the latter. I think you can fall in a kind of love with them that you demonstrate by paying so much attention to them day after day. And by trying, I always feel like I'm kind of looking at them going, is there anything I'm missing here? Like, am I, I know I've been unfair to you, but I've also been pretty fair to you at other times. Is there anything about you that I should know, you know? So that's love, or it's attention at any rate. I think the idea that your feelings could flicker on and off hundreds of times in a story, you could feel great affection for a character and then they do something terrible. Well, it doesn't exactly override the first thing. It complicates it, you know? So I kind of like that idea of a story as a system of a dynamic system that doesn't really stay steady, much like the world. I mean, it's that same feeling.
Well, and it's all about the ultimate goal of good art or good writing, and that is to connect humanity, right? To
exactly.
You as the reader understand that you're not alone, that you are part of this whole web.
That's it. We're not saying at any point that we've got this figured out. We're not really even saying that literature is going to give us an answer. But I think the act of huddling, you know, together is really hopeful, and not in a gauzy way, but practically speaking, you know, when I read a good story and I come out on the other end, I just feel kind of like seen, you know, or like, okay, I have these crazy thoughts, these crazy impulses. That writer seems to get me. Phew. Okay. You know,
I am not alone, not alone right. at all.
That's right. And that's a lot, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot these days, especially. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, for being with us today.
Oh, I love talking to you. Thank you so much for reading the story so closely.
Oh, my pleasure. George Saunders, his latest short story collection is called Liberation Day. He'll be in LA next month for an event hosted by Skylight Books, and that's on Thursday, November 3rd at the Zipper Concert Hall that's at the Colburn School downtown. George Saunders, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
For me too. Thank you so much.
Coming up, Evan Kleiman is here to talk about Halloween candy for adults. That's next on Press Play.